I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to start our program today with an issue that has been in the news of late, but it has been on the minds of many college students and their families long before that. And that issue is sexual assault on college campuses. The Department of Justice says 1 in 5 women has been sexually assaulted while in college. So the Obama administration is out with new guidelines for colleges about how to stop this behavior. In a few minutes, we will hear from Rhonda Henry of the University of Kentucky on how their program teaches bystanders to intervene. But first, we are joined by United States Senator Claire McCaskill. She is a Democrat from Missouri. She spent a lot of time working on the issue of sexual violence on campus and in other areas, and she's with us now from her office in Washington, D.C. Senator McCaskill, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I think many people might know of your work combating sexual violence in the military that has gotten a lot of attention in recent months. Now you've turned to the issue of college campuses. Can I ask what drew your attention to this in the first place?
Well, I spent years in the courtroom as a sexual assault prosecutor, so I understand this crime. I understand the complexities, and I most of all understand how critically important it is to get victim support and services to the victim in a way that encourages her to come forward out of the shadows at the most traumatic moment of her life. And so it's a natural in that there's many similarities between the problems that we encountered in the military and the problems that we see on college campuses. And it also probably has something to do with the fact that I have two daughters that are around the age of college.
Yeah, just briefly, because this is obviously a very complex subject and you've dealt into it, you know, you've dug very deeply into it. Can you just give me one or two examples of where you feel like the college campus experience is similar to the issue as you've been studying it in the military? Because a lot of people think that part of the issue with the military is it's a closed environment. There are very, very few women in the military serving. I mean, only, 11 or 12% of active duty service members are female. Very different on college campuses, where in some cases women are the majority. So tell me a little bit more about what you see the similarities as being.
Well, they're both closed environments in that there is a great deal of information that is shared within this closed environment, which means that your peers all find out, and there is fear that there will be repercussions, retaliation, that you will be marginalized if you come forward. So the closed nature of both a military base and a college campus is similar. The other thing is that these young people at the ages of 17, 18, 19 years old are coming into a new environment where they expect safety and where they are presented with a whole new system of rules and regulations, or in some instances, none. Yeah. Going from a home where they had supervision to an environment where there is some requirements, obviously in the military, about where you are and what you're doing, but there you are still independent for the first time in your life. So, I think those things all, and the fact that it's complex. There is dual jurisdiction in both cases, in that depending on where the assault occurs, you could have the military justice system or the civilian justice system that could weigh in. And also on a university campus, you could have the university police or the municipal police. So we have law enforcement coordination issues also.
So what are some of the things that you want to do about it? We noted that the White House has released some guidelines to increase the pressure on universities to move more aggressively on this issue. One of the recommendations is to conduct anonymous surveys about sexual assault cases, to adopt some policies that have been considered successful at other universities. We're going to hear more about that in a few minutes. What are some of the things, and to better ensure that reports remain confidential, but what are some of the things that you think are most important? Could you just give us one or two things that you think would make a significant difference?
I think most important is a process and system where at the point of report, the victim has the option of confidentiality, but as important, a forensic interview that supports her rather than accuses her, that allows her to give a factual version of what occurred as to what she remembers, without making her feel like that she's got to pass some test to be believable. And then the second piece of that is acknowledging that Title IX is never going to hold perpetrators accountable criminally. And the way victims are going to feel empowered is believing something might happen if they come forward. So we've got to do a better job linking law enforcement on campuses with local law enforcement and local prosecutors, because the federal government has no jurisdiction to criminally prosecute these rape cases on college campuses, none. So this has to be a local prosecutor driven process, and we've got to pull them in and hopefully do some things that would mandate universities to work more closely and carefully with local law enforcement on these incidents.
That was Senator Claire McCaskill. She's a Democrat of Missouri. She's been working very extensively on this issue, and she joined us from her office in Washington, D.C. Senator McCaskill, thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely.
Thanks
for having
me. We'll speak again as this issue proceeds.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Now we're joined by Rhonda Henry. She's acting director of the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center, with us from member station WUKY, which is in Lexington, Kentucky. And the program at her university has been held up as a model by the White House and others. So Rhonda Henry, thanks for joining us. Give us an example, first of all, of the scope of the issue, if you would, from your campus.
Certainly. Thank you for having me on today, Michelle. We certainly see clients coming in every day who have experienced some form of interpersonal violence, and we certainly see sexual violence on a regular basis, unfortunately. We do think that we've got some components that we've put in place within our programming to respond to that and to work on the prevention side as well. But we see the reality, unfortunately, coming in all the time, and I don't think our college campus is any different than any other. We know that those risk factors are there.
And what are some of those risk factors? I mean, why is this such a prevalent issue? I mean, you think it's alcohol? I mean, do you think that alcohol is part of it? Do you think it's that some young people come to campus not understanding what's right and wrong? I mean, that they don't understand that it's, I mean, do you think it's just as simple as some students do simply do not understand that it is not acceptable to force yourself on people, women in particular, who do not welcome your advances, or if somebody's so drunk that they can't give consent that some kids think that's still okay? I mean, do you think, what is the issue here?
Well, I definitely think that there is a connection between sexual violence and substance use and abuse. I don't think it's a causal relationship, but I think that we definitely see that substance use lowers inhibitions, so it's not going to turn someone who doesn't have maybe a violent or abusive tendencies in their personality, it's not going to turn them into that, but it's going to lower inhibitions and maybe impair decision-making, just like it would in any other type of situation we might be in. On the side of the victim, it may also impair their ability to notice red flags maybe earlier on, to, you know, be able to make safety plans in a moment or to follow through with, you know, planning to go home with friends. And once, you know, alcohol or other drugs get involved, it makes decision-making a little more impaired. I certainly, like I said, don't think there's a causal relationship, but I think it's part of the complexity of it. I think sometimes there are people who don't realize that the activities they're perpetrating against someone else are crossing the line and don't really understand consent, but I think most of the time they do and push along that line anyway. A lot of times we'll hear that idea of, you know, turning a no into a yes, you know, being able to push someone along or try to talk them into doing something that maybe they initially didn't want to do, and really helping people understand the true meaning of consent, you know, and that consent is not just it's not just fighting back or not fighting back. It's also being an active participant and wanting to participate in that activity as well.
So tell me a bit more about those bystander training that we're talking about here. We have about 3 minutes, and I understand it's a really something that you work along, but give us the kind of the executive summary version, if you will.
Certainly. The Green Dot Program is a comprehensive primary prevention strategy that focuses on the power of the bystander to help make individual and social change. So the way that we approach that and the way that we kind of go into those trainings is we have a skill building approach to enable people to safely intervene in red flag situations. You know, the last thing we want to do is have someone get involved trying to help and put someone else at risk or raise the level of, you know, dangerousness that's going on. So we do a lot of work with people about understanding everything from their own personality style and what is a way to intervene that would feel comfortable for them, but also kind of judging who else is around. Are there other support people that they may be able to delegate or bring in to help with the situation? They may be able to distract the person from what's going on, or depending on what their relationship is potentially with the people involved, they may feel like they can directly go into a situation.
Is this something, forgive me for interrupting here, I have about 2 minutes left. How is this something that all students participate in, or is this something that only student leaders participate in? Because it seems to me that a lot of these situations that we hear about happen at off-campus parties and things of that sort. I mean, it's true that some of these things happen kind of on campus, but a lot of these situations that have come to light, particularly some of the ones that turn violent, are situations that are happening at off-campus parties where I don't think the student body president has happened to be standing there. So how does this infect the – how do you get the entire student body, people who are most likely to be involved with this, to participate?
Certainly. We, you know, unfortunately, we don't have the opportunity to talk with every person on campus who comes through. And so we've got sort of a multi-pronged approach. One is looking at those leaders, like you said, people who are in positions of leadership, formally or informally, you know, within their social circle. But that can't be the only place that we go to. So we also look for other ways to tie this into either current academic programs that are going on or other social or groups that are already formed, and to be able to really spread that message that it's everybody's issue. So it's not just, you know, a Greek organization's president who's got to, you know, have this knowledge and move forward. It's everyone. It's not just a social club's president or leadership, but that everyone has to be involved in that.
Okay.
And we're constantly looking for those opportunities to get that information out to a more diverse group of people.
And finally, what kind of reaction are you getting from the students? Not just your student body president, leadership people, but your student population overall. What kind of reaction are you getting to this kind of training?
We have a really positive response to this. And I think one of the main reasons is because it's manageable. We're not asking them to go out and change the entire campus alone. We're asking them to do what they're already doing. Work in their peer groups, you know, influence the people that they're around, make a positive impact in their life as they live it on a day-to-day basis, because it can't just be the chief of police or someone from my office or someone from the dean of students making those changes. We have our own roles in this, but it's that day-to-day within social interaction actions and really empowering them to know they can make a difference.
Rhonda Henry is Acting Director of the University of Kentucky's Violence Intervention and Prevention Center. Thank you so much for joining us, Rhonda Henry.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Friday, the Barbershop Guys give a big thumbs up to People magazine, naming Lupita Nyong'o the most beautiful woman in the world.
It's actually a revolutionary moment to have an African woman with African features as the most beautiful. It's a moment of progress, especially for white people. So mad props to white people. You get it.
We'll see what our diverse panel of women think. It's The Beauty Shop, and that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support comes from the Illini Pella Window Stores, offering a full range of residential and commercial Pella products, including the Architect Series, Designer Series, and Proline Series of windows and doors. Illini Pella showrooms are located in Springfield, Decatur, Champaign, Bloomington, and Danville.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now it's time for a visit to the Beauty Shop. That's where our panel of women commentators and journalists take a fresh cut on the week's news. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Bridget Johnson, Washington, D.C. editor of PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian news and commentary site here in D.C. In California, we have Jill Monroe, whose blog Jocks and Stiletto Jill dubs itself as ESPN meets Sex in the City. Actress Nana Mensah is back with us. She's with the breakout web series An African City, and she joins us from Austin, Texas. And with us from New York, Laura Martinez. She's a freelance journalist and author of the blog Mi Blog Es Tu Blog. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Happy to be back. Thank you.
So let's start with the story that has really been kind of all over the news this week, the racist comments made by Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, and he has now acknowledged that he made those comments. He made them to his girlfriend, V. Stiviano. Well, they're going to cost him. This is NBA Commissioner Adam Silver speaking on Tuesday.
Effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
All right, Jill, you know I'm going to start with you. First of all, just give me your top of the line on this.
I think that it's a great move. I know that some people are upset that it took so long because, for example, here in Los Angeles, we've known for quite some time about Donald Sterling and his beliefs. But with the logistics, the lawsuits that have happened with him, most of them settled. So legally, there's no, you know, there wasn't really a way for the NBA to step in and take action. When these comments came out, although they were garnered in a sort of undesirable fashion, you had to take action. The players were upset, the fans were upset, the owners were upset. And I think that I applaud the moves they make. They did as much as they could do with the NBA's extent. And now it's on the owners to take over and make sure that that process continues and he's moved out of the NBA.
Can I just ask you, Joe, you said that this was something that was known to people for a while. Is it that people had just given up on there being any recourse here?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that was my question. Was it a kind of thing where people just felt that there was nothing that they were just going to live with it as long as they had to? Or
I think that that was it, and I think that the desire was to support the players. And because the Clippers had been bad for so long, it sort of went under the radar for the greater, you know, audience maybe outside of Los Angeles. So you support the players. That's why the players always left. It was sort of you stood with them, but maybe the owner wasn't really a part of it. You knew he was the owner, but he wasn't like Jerry Buss or Mark Cuban where you saw him actively involved with the team. So I think it was easy just sort of push back, and everyone takes the approach, well, you know, we all work with someone that may not share our same views, but it's not really about them.
Interesting. Bridget, what do you think? You're a native of Los Angeles. What's your take on this?
Yes, I was born down the street from the Great Western Forum, and I have to say one of my thoughts about this is that, you know, I see all my childhood NBA heroes being paraded across CNN, Kareem and AC Green. I'm like, why does it take a racist to bring all of them together like this? So we have some.
There are some people who are. I've been looking at some of the comments on your site and other sites, and particularly the conservative sites, where people are objecting, saying, you know, he's a right to his personal opinions, and he's got a right to his personal views, and you know, that's
yeah,
it.
And you know, we have to kind of ask too. You know, was this an illegal wiretapping? I know there's some question about that or not. People are allowed to be racist jerks in their home. But I think the problems here is that first you have a pattern of behavior. I'd go back to Elgin Baylor's lawsuit. And once the cat was out of the bag and this was exposed, you know, what are you going to do? Because it's not like people can just stop patronizing the business. It's not like his employees can just go find a new place to play. So it's not like that the NBA commissioner was shuffling things around in a traditional business environment. You know, once this was out of the bag, you know, it was a PR decision that needed to be made. It needed to be made quickly, and I think you did the right thing.
Nana, what do you think? I know that the Clippers players went on, after the tape surfaced, the Clippers players went on with the game where they turned their jerseys inside out to make a statement. So,
what kind of statement is that? I mean, I it's interesting what you were saying about employees finding a new place to play. I mean, how much more would we have respected these men, these millionaires, if they had refused to play under this owner? I mean, if we look at what's actually happening here, Sterling's net worth is $1.9 billion. And this fine of $2.5 million, it's the equivalent of fining somebody with a net worth of $50,000, $65.78. It's a drop in the bucket for Donald Sterling. And he bought the team for $12 million in 1981 and is going to sell it. It's now worth well over $575 million. So it's
darn
like,
it, I was going to take up a collection when you said $12 million.
Oh, man.
You know,
sorry.
But I mean, if you look at that, like, is this man really being punished? At the end of the day, it's going to result in a windfall for him. And not only that, like, my hugest issue with this, with everything, V. Stiviano and her, you know, thunderously, I mean, unintelligent, you know, remarks on this tape. I mean, there are so many angles. It's so multifaceted. But the thing that really gets me is the fact that the LA Clippers had an opportunity. They had an opportunity to bench themselves. They should have said, we are not playing for this man. We are not going to sit, you know, we are not, it doesn't matter our love of the game. We're willing to put that aside. Breaking our contract, we'll put that aside. We are going to sit until action is taken and we no longer have to play for to this man who is since 2003, you know, I mean, that first lawsuit in 2003, we have known publicly for 11 years that Donald Sterling is an absolute racist nincompoop. And yet somehow it's only now that, you know, you attach a half black, half Mexican, I would call him Blexican, you attach that to this and all of a sudden it's now newsworthy. And that's so disappointing to me in terms of the American public.
Hmm. Well, I don't know. You mentioned the tape, so let me just play a little bit of it.
You're supposed to be a delicate white or a delicate Latina girl.
I'm a mixed girl.
Okay. Well, but
and you're in love with me. And I'm black and Mexican, whether you like it or not,
okay.
Whether the world accepts it or not.
So, I don't know. She seems pretty right here. I mean,
she also does make comments saying she wishes she could, you know, erase the color of her skin. She, you know, I mean, she is not necessarily like the upholding presence for.
Well, I don't know. I mean, well, she's the vehicle by which this information became known. So,
but why did it become known?
Well, let's hear from Laura on this. Laura, what do you think about all this?
It's very funny because I was just reading a lot of comments. Obviously, from the my focus has been on the Mexican part of the equation, which is Stiviano. Which, by the way, I've been reading that her real name is Vanessa Perez, and that she has claimed in the past that she changed her name because she feels like being a Perez or a Martinez, you know, like myself. It really puts you like in the lower end of when you live in the U.S. So it's interesting that she picked a so-called Italian kind of name, or it sounds Italian to me. But what is interesting is also the comments that I've seen from people, like saying it is amazing how she would come out as black in the U.S., but in Mexico probably she would just not even be considered Mexican. And I've seen some very offending comments about her as well. I do agree with the other panelists that this woman is not very bright. I heard a lot of the tape. And you can tell that she's really playing the guy, and she's really doing her best to have the guy say the things he said. I am also, I mean, I'm kind of glad that the feminists and the Mexicans have not yet come to her, like, defense. But I think it's been really interesting to watch. I mean, this has brought Latinos, non-Latinos, Mexicans, blacks, whites together. To me, it's a really interesting phenomenon.
You know what's funny, Nana, just briefly on this, for people who aren't familiar with your series, your character in the show that you are in, An African City, which we've covered on this program, and I hope people go back and listen to our conversation, your character, Sade, that's her whole deal, is relationships with
sugar. She and V have a lot in common.
That's how she lives.
It's her whole deal.
So I don't know if you, just based on your acting, your embodiment of this role, you want to give us some insight into how V is making it work.
Well, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because the thing is that, you know, Sade, my character on An African City, she also, you know, went to Georgetown undergrad and went to Harvard Business School, and she has her own career. She takes supplemental income from her, you know, wealthy, you know, dating her, the men in her life. But if you look at V. Stiviano, I mean, I think something that nobody's talking about that I would just love to point out on this show is the fact that she's being sued by Sterling's wife, Rochelle Stein Sterling. She's being sued for $1.8 million. V. Stiviano does not have $1.8 million, but she will after the fact that she leaked this tape to TMZ.
Well,
you know, like, that's a motivation that I think nobody's necessarily, you know, talking about.
I wanted to say something.
Go ahead,
Laura. Okay. No, real quick, just picking up on that. The story that I read, she uses a lot of, she's using two hashtags on her Instagrams, Stiviano. One was Random House and the other was Simon and Schuster. So that was very interesting because I think she's really preparing herself.
Gearing up for a book deal.
I have some clarity in this. Because Donald Sterling bought her a condo worth $1.8 million. Well, not a condo, a duplex in the Los Angeles area. She also worked for his charity organization. Sounds like a role that he just put her in to sort of supplement that income. And he's given her four cars. She's also good friends with Corinne Stephens. Steffens, who wrote Confessions of a Video Vixen. So there's a lot going on there with that. She obviously had ulterior motives, and his wife was concerned that she was sort of milking him, taking advantage of him in her situation.
Well, but that's one of the reasons I brought it up, and one of the things I find fascinating is I think that there's been a lot of news about this whole phenomenon overseas, you know, with people with who have incredible wealth in some of the rising economies, like in China and Russia and in countries in Africa. We're having these outside relationships where these women are very heavily supported, but somehow we seem to think that this doesn't go on in the United States. Hello?
True.
Hello? Hello?
Especially in the sports community. It's something that happens quite a bit in
the
sports community all the time. And to be fair and to be honest, the wife knew. She has been involved with him for 4 years. It seems like they had some sort of agreement, and maybe when the gifts started getting a bit more extravagant, or this property, which she says was actually something that was supposed to be part of their holdings and not to be given as a gift, that's where the problem started.
I don't know if they had an agreement. See, the thing is, we never really know what's going on in these kinds of relationships. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the more wealth you have, the more ability you have to hide it and to distribute it in ways that other people can't track. So, you know, so who knows? You know, all we do know, and we don't even know that she leaked this tape. All we do know is that now that we know what we know, and what it changes about what we, I don't know. I just think it's kind of important to kind of point out to people that these relationships where people are maintaining, these very wealthy men are maintaining these relationships with women for whatever reason, are not exclusive to the developing world. That's all I kind of wanted to say about
oh,
that.
God.
So anyway, you're listening to the Beauty Shop Roundtable. If you've just joined it, our guests are Bridget Johnson of PJ Media, bloggers Jill Monroe and Laura Martinez, and actress Nana Mensa. So I don't know, we wanted to spend a minute talking about an important international story. And unfortunately, again, we've kind of done the same thing that I think a lot of people want to or feel very badly about, which is that did you know that, you know, more than 200 girls were kidnapped from their boarding school in northern Nigeria? The suspects are members of this militant Islamic group, Boko Haram. And reports are surfacing that these girls are being forced into marriages with members of the group. And Bridget, one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up is that you are very involved with reporting on a lot of these international stories that sometimes don't get as much attention. And you just have to contrast. I'm not into competitive suffering, but I just have to point out that at a time there's been tremendous attention devoted to the South Korean ferry disaster that cost like 300 people their lives, and of course the missing Malaysian airliner, and these 200 girls, young girls, are somehow out there. We don't seem to know as much about it, and I just wonder what's your take on why that is.
It's very disturbing because these 200 or so girls are essentially the canaries in the coal mine right now for international terrorism. Boko Haram has been stoking its alliance with Al-Qaeda. In 2012, we learned from U.S. Africa Command that they were training with other Al-Qaeda groups in an Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb-controlled area the size of Texas. We found out at a hearing last year where it was barely attended, but we heard from Boko Haram survivors, people who had been shot in the face, and we had a State Department official saying there, we don't know the size of the group. And so now, you know, what we have is an indication that Nigeria does not have control over this growing threat. We have these girls being shuttled off through over Lake Chad. We have tons of, I was looking through Nigerian media reports last night, and villagers, scores of them, saying, you know, we saw the girls in a convoy. We saw the girls in canoes being taken across Lake Chad. We know that the Boko Haram members were paying $2,000 Nigerian each to marry these girls. And this is an absolute travesty, and it's not unprecedented.
I wanted to ask Laura, since Twitter has been focusing on this issue with the hashtag #BringBackOurGirls,
right.
And as a blogger, I'm just wondering, are you seeing... Do you feel that this is a situation where, you know, social media can be a force here, or is this, again, showing the limits of social media?
I think it's a little bit of both, but it is true that when I first went to look for more information, I found tons of things under, and there's actually two hashtags. There is bring back our daughters, or where are our daughters? And then it was bring back our girls. I think one of the things that were actually started on Twitter was a march that that is taking place or took place today, which was the 1 million women march. I don't believe they gather a million people, but I think this is something positive. I mean, it speaks well of what you can do in social media. Of course, social media or Twitter are not going to bring these girls back.
Sure.
But the fact that you can raise awareness and you can get people finding out about these stories that otherwise they wouldn't, I think it's pretty important.
Well, we're going to end on a happier note. We only have about a minute left. We're talking about actress Lupita Nyong'o being named the most beautiful person in the world by People magazine. A lot of people are calling it a milestone that a dark-skinned African woman was recognized in this way. And so, Nana, as an actress who's also in the same field with African roots, I wanted to ask if her recognition means something special to you.
It does mean something very special to me, and I am incredibly proud that she is African and all of those wonderful things. I would love for her next. I think the thing is that right now she's got contracts with Miu Miu and Lancome. What those contracts are going to afford her is an ability to be very selective about what her subsequent roles are. And she is somebody who came to prominence for playing a slave. And this is a conversation that we've continually had in terms of Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer coming to prominence playing maids. Like, I would be so happy if there was a role coming up for Zooey Deschanel and they cast Lupita instead moving forward, in a small independent film or something along those lines. I think that what it means is that we can start breaking down the color barrier and having, instead of having a film with a black female lead, having that be a black film, let it just be a film. And so that's what I'm so hopeful for.
Well, you're all my most beautiful people.
I just wanted to add real quick that we Latinos have adopted her because her name is Lupita.
She's Mexican.
Right. Well, I'm going to find some way to adopt her too, just because I think she's so fabulous. Bridget Johnson, Nana Mensah, Laura Martinez, and oh my gosh, who am I forgetting?
Jill Monroe.
Sorry, Jill. We can give you your love. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, we celebrate International Jazz Day by taking a trip around the world. And it might not sound like the jazz you're used to hearing. Felix Contreras of NPR's Alt Latino shares some jazz with an international flavor. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients at cancercenter.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
There's noodles to make and chicken to be plucked.
That's Sheldon Harnick singing a lyric he wrote but never used for Fiddler on the Roof. The recording is on the new album of Harnick songs called Hidden Treasures. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Fiddler on the Roof, and it's Harnick's 90th birthday. A new interview with Sheldon Harnick on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Our broadcast day is made possible in part thanks to the generous contributions from the Friends of WILL. And by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Three's a Charm on Saturday, May 3rd at 7:30 p.m. in the Follinger Great Hall at Cranert. With pianist and conductor Ian Hobson, Sinfonia will perform three Beethoven favorites.
Next time on Ask Me Another, Peter Sagal, the sheriff of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, recalls a showdown in his family's grocery store.
Because I'm me, I'd have a little bit of dialogue
with
the yogurt. So, I told you never to come back to this dairy section again.
Join me, Deputy Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's guiltiest and most puzzling pleasure.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. There are a lot of things to celebrate today. It's our 7th anniversary on the air, for one thing, so happy birthday to us. And what better way to celebrate than talking about music, because it also happens to be International Jazz Day. That genre has come a long way from its birth in the American South. You can listen to jazz music around the world today, but it might sound a little different than what you're used to hearing. We wanted to get a little bit of that international jazz flavor. So today we're talking about some jazz musicians from abroad who are taking center stage here in the U.S. with Felix Contreras. He's co-host of NPR's Alt Latino, and he's with us once again to tell us more about some of these artists. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
Well, thank you. Now, speaking of days, sometimes I have to confess I get a little squeamish when I hear about this day or week or month because I want to know who decided that. So do we know who decided that it was International Jazz Day?
Herbie Hancock.
Okay, enough. That's all that need be said.
He was, a couple of years ago, he was selected as UNESCO's ambassador for promotion of intercultural dialogue. Okay, so jazz, of course, is one of his expressions, just one of his many expressions. So I guess he's using that to promote that intercultural dialogue using something he knows best, which is jazz.
So what are we going to hear first?
We're going to start in Haiti. We're going to start with a guy named Jacques Soarge Barthe, and he's got a great album out. He's a saxophonist. His mother's from Guadeloupe. She played traditional voodoo music around the house, and one of his main goals, he says, is to dispel the negative connotation of voodoo, because it's really been distorted by popular media around the world. It's a sacred religion, much like Santeria from Cuba or Candomblé from Brazil. Now, this song that we're going to hear is an arrangement of a traditional voodoo chant that's turned into a jazz arrangement. Isn't that brilliant?
It is. It is. It's great. You know, it's interesting because jazz started out being kind of outsider music anyway, right?
Sure.
And kind of a little bit disreputable by the classy people.
Sure.
But now it's gone in-house, right? It's gone inside. Are the people who are purists who think that that kind of music is outside the canon or don't really think it belongs in the realm of jazz?
When it did start, it started, depends on which theory you believe, but it, you know, New Orleans, I think, is considered and pretty much agreed on that that's where it sort of got its start. New Orleans at that time was considered the northernmost port of Havana, northernmost port of Cuba. So there's a lot of different influences in the start of jazz. You know, the purists are always going to have something to say about it, you know, whether or not this is jazz or not. But I think it's moves the music forward whenever you include other elements. Like that song we just heard, I don't have a problem calling that jazz at all.
What else do you have for us?
Okay, next we're going to go to Cuba. Speaking of Cuba and New Orleans, this is Yosvani Terry, and he's got an album called New Throned King. He was born in Cuba. His father was Cuban. His mother was Haitian. And his album connects the dots between those two very closely related cultures. You know, they use music and rhythm from the Arara tradition, which is African, and it comes from a part of Africa that is now Benin. It's a very ambitious album, and I think it really works because it brilliantly mixes those two traditions that have a common culture in Africa.
Thank you.
Again, another saxophonist approximating the human voice, which is what jazz musicians do when they're playing real book ballads.
You know, looping back to what we were talking about earlier, how jazz used to be considered outside, but now it's very much inside the kind of the canon of respected musical traditions, like a lot of those sort of classical musical traditions. It's not selling as much as well in the U.S. as it was a few decades ago. What about outside of the country?
It's the same. You know, it's always going to be a small niche, a small part of each country or each culture's, you know, recorded output, their retail output. A successful jazz album here is going to be maybe close to what Pitbull's catering bill is on one of his video shoots. You know what I mean? It's just, that's just how small it is. But it doesn't take away from, you know, the artistic integrity of the music.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's International Jazz Day, so says Herbie Hancock, and we, of course, listen to everything he says. And I'm speaking with Felix Contreras, who is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino, and we're focusing on international jazz artists who are placing roots here in the U.S. So let's get back to more music. What do you want to hear next?
Okay, in order to appreciate what I'm going to play next, you got to hear this first. This is MIA's Paper Planes.
I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around, hey, I'll make them all day. I get one down in a second if you wait. I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around, hey, I'll make them all day. I get one down in a second if you wait. Sometimes I think sitting on trains.
Now, this is how a singer by the name of Kavita Shaw made her own version of this.
Fly like paper, get high like. Catch me on the border, I got visas in my. Come around here, I'll make them all. Get one down in a second if you. Fly like paper, get high like planes. Catch me on the border, I got visas in my name. Come around here, I'll make them all day. Get one done in a second if you wait. Dum ba da dum da 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 da.
I'm not sure I would call it jazz.
It stretches the boundaries, you know, yeah. This particular track. The rest of the album, she does more traditional straight-ahead jazz singing. You know, she's of Indian descent. She was raised here in the United States, but she is of South Asian descent. She's lived in Brazil. She speaks Portuguese, French, English, a little bit of Spanish. She's a musicologist from Harvard. Her album is called Visions, and it's a mix of her experiences, different cultures of music and musicians. It's produced by a guy named Lionel Lueke, who is from Benin. And who played with Herbie? Oh. So it all comes, you know, it all comes around.
Can you spell mashup?
But it does. It does stretch that definition. But improvised music, I think, for me, it's all part of the same thing.
Well, we have time for one more song. So what's your last selection?
Okay. International jazz is not anything new. People have been doing it for decades. And you can go back to Dollar Brand from South Africa, Gato Barbieri from Argentina, and Monty Alexander from Jamaica. He got his start in the 60s playing with people like Frank Sinatra, Dizzy Gillespie, Tony Bennett, Sonny Rollins, Quincy Jones, etc. In 2005, he is from Jamaica. In 2005, he fully embraced Bob Marley, created this great album called Concrete Jungle. And since then, he's mixed in a lot more Jamaican folk music into his music. This is a track called Scamento.
Going from here, I mean, there are some people who argue that, you know, part of the reason that jazz isn't as popular a genre as it used to be is that it used to be dance music,
sure,
and party music, and now it's music that people kind of listen to, and so that's kind of why it's kind of become a niche thing. And what's your take on that? You could dance to this.
Yeah,
this
absolutely. Be, yeah. This is where I think the purists have taken over and influenced what people think of as jazz. I think a lot of people are intimidated by jazz. They hear all these crazy chord changes. They hear all this stuff. You know, where's it going? It's going to grow, and it's going to completely always challenge that definition of jazz and give us all something that we can find in the music.
And, so and the internationalness of the global nature of the art of the work now kind of speaks to that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Right. Looking back on it, it's like walking up a street, any street in New York, because you're going to hear music coming from different types of cultures, from different places, from different little stores, video stores, bodegas, etc. This is what jazz is hearing.
I'm going to give you one more chance. I said that was the last piece of music, but do you have one more cut you'd like to go out on? Anything else you want to leave us with as we think about International Jazz Day?
There's a guy named Tigran Hamasyan. He's originally from Armenia. He moved here when he was 14. He won the Thelonious Monk Piano Competition in 2006. We had him at Jazz Piano Christmas shortly after that here at the Kennedy Center from NPR. Very, very interesting and very nice, talented young man. And what he's done is taken that jazz tradition and he's mixed it with Armenian folk, a little bit of electronica, a little bit of just a tiny bit of pop. Very, very interesting. I never would have expected him to take this route. But again, I think it's all part of the bigger umbrella of what we call jazz.
Okay, tell us one more time. What are we going to hear?
This is Tigran Hamasyan. The album's called Shadow Theater, and this track is called Seafarer.
All right, Seafarer. Thanks. Felix Contreras is co-host of NPR's Alt Latino. He was kind enough to join us from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Thanks for sharing this with us. Happy International Jazz Day to you. Happy birthday to Tell Me More.
Yes,
Felix,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Finally today, if I could have a few words about the kerfuffle over First Lady Michelle Obama's planned trip to speak to high school graduates in Topeka, Kansas next month, coinciding with the anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark decision on school desegregation, Brown versus Board of Education. Some parents had complained that as much as they'd love to hear from the First Lady, they were worried that her presence might overshadow their children's accomplishments. Some said they'd already invited many family members and were worried that they would now have to uninvite them because they would be limited to a few tickets each. Others worried that the security apparatus would be overwhelming. So a compromise has been worked out. The First Lady will speak at a special senior recognition a day earlier than the original. But can I just tell you, actually it's more of a confession, I was slightly annoyed when I first heard these complaints. Not just because graduations have been the occasion of some of the President and Mrs. Obama's most moving and important messages, but also because it seemed incredibly small. Graduations are not just, to use an overworked commencement speech cliche, an end, but a beginning, a time to think about what's next. I thought making a fuss over a high school graduation implied that this is the end of the road, the high point of what we can expect from these young people. And what kind of message is that? But then I went to a graduation ceremony last weekend where my husband was honored by his law school alma mater with an honorary degree. Yes, I'm slipping that one in. I have to tell you that it reminded me about why these ceremonies are such important personal occasions as well as public ones. First, as we told you yesterday, graduations from high school are on the way up. 80% of Americans now graduate from high school, with the biggest growth among African American and Hispanic students. And that is something to celebrate. But it's also worth noting that just 30% of Americans now have a bachelor's degree. So for the millions of graduates who do not go on to college, that walk across the high school stage is still the only one. It may be hard for people in the everybody gets a trophy world of middle class parenting to remember that some kids never get one. So if they finally do, It's cherished. Equally important are all the stories about what it takes each individual to get there. At my husband's alma mater, I love the decorated mortar boards. One guy was even controlling an animation on his from his smartphone. I'm betting that guy has a job. But most messages were of thanks to mom and dad and friends for what they did to get them across the finish line. Equally moving for me were the stories I heard from some of my husband's law school classmates who had attended that school at a time when segregation was no longer the law of the land, but at a time when some of their professors were still so nakedly hostile to the small group of black students there that upperclassmen felt compelled to warn the newcomers not to be shocked that even the ablest among them would likely never see top grades, no matter how much they deserved them. It was a way of making sure that even if the law could not, there would be no law review, no invitations to top firms. So you can understand how emotional it was for all of them, all of us, to see one of their own honored by the same institution. Getting back to the Michelle Obama dust-up, history does matter, to use another commencement cliche, because if you don't know where you've been, it's harder to appreciate where you are going. But at a time when we are quick to complain that young people all think they're supposed to be on television, maybe we should also applaud those who felt that a selfie with family is even more important than a selfie with a celebrity, even when as down-to-earth as Michelle Obama. You can do both, and the compromise worked out ensures that. Not a bad commencement message, as it turns out. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.